All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Epic Failing Podcast. Today I have with us Michael Peterson. He is an award-winning filmmaker from Calgary. Hey, Michael.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. Maybe tell everybody a little bit about yourself.
Well, I moved to Calgary when I was in grade school from Toronto, and then grew up here. Moved away to go to school at York University. Then I went to the University of North Carolina to do my master's degree. And then I moved to LA. And during that time, I was making documentaries, which is where I started out and sort of doing every sort of crew job in the world on a film, from working at development offices to editing and doing a little bit of sound and everything in between. And then to transition from documentary to scripted is not necessarily a natural step. So to create that opportunity for myself, I had to sort of start working in writing and directing and producing short films. And I made a lot of sci-fi type short films with robots. And I've sort of always been interested in, I guess, the genre world in the broad sense. Made my first feature called Lloyd the Conqueror in Calgary after I moved back from LA.
That was Brian Posehn is in that one, isn't he?
Yeah, Brian Posehn and Mike Smith, who's Bubbles from Trailer Park Boys.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
A couple other people like that, Harland Williams. So that was my first feature as a director. And then after that, I went to the Canadian Film Center for their directing program. They select about six people from across the country every year on the director's program, and I was lucky enough to be one of those. And then came back to town and then directed some TV and produced some features and sort of have gotten even more hyper-focused and sort of director-driven genre films. My next feature after that was a thriller called Knuckleball with Michael Ironside and Monroe Chambers and Luca Velasquez. And then produced a bunch of other horrors, dark comedies, things like that. The most recent that's available to the public, probably Harpoon, which has done, you know, exceptionally well. I just got a note this morning that I think we're getting an offer for Malaysia. We just sold to Japan and we've sold about 25 territories or something like that for that project. So it's a pretty nice success story for a locally produced film. And that's with a director that we've done, I don't know, four projects together. And we're just working on his fifth right now. So hopefully once COVID lets up, we'll be able to make that sucker. And then there's a werewolf movie, which will have its premiere. It's called Bloodthirsty. And I was one of the producers on that. And that'll premiere at Fantastic Fest in Austin.
That's awesome. And when is Fantastic Fest?
I think it's in a few days. Its world premiere will be October 1st.
Perfect. So maybe just a little bit behind the scenes, I'm just going to backtrack a little bit here.
Yeah.
So when you've made your movie, I love marketing, and actually I really love film. I'm a huge film buff. In fact, I kind of wanted to get into film like right out of high school, but you know, things happen.
Yeah, sure.
So you make this film and then you sell the rights to it to different countries. And just for the layman, like how does that generally work?
There's a number of different paths to get there. Sort of the one that we've done the most is make a film, premiere it at a festival that has some market presence, use the publicity and the market capabilities of that festival to either launch the sales from. We're usually working with a sales company, and it's often broken up as domestically and then internationally. So there might be a sales company that's doing everything, or they might be just looking after North America. And then the other one is looking after the rest of the world. And then together we find the people that will hopefully, you know, be the right partners to take the film out to their territory. They usually pay us some sort of advance on that. That's essentially they're paying for the rights to license the film in that territory over the various platforms. If you sell to someone like a Netflix, usually that's a one-off world deal. And typically the other rights, you either don't have them or just aren't able to sell other things because there's not enough value left in the property. So if you're doing a deal like that, it's going to kind of make up for whatever you think you'd sell the rest of the world for if you broke it up.
No, that makes total sense. And you say that you started like right from the bottom, right from square one. I mean, that's something that I think a lot of people think it's like who you know and whatnot. What got you into filmmaking right from the beginning, day one?
My parents were big film lovers. my dad would take me to, you know, Three Stooges Film Festival at the Plaza Theater, or a Shakespeare on Film Festival at the Plaza Theater. We probably went to, on average, 1 to 2 movies a week. So we were just kind of watching everything that came into the theaters. Like, I can remember many times where, you know, it'd be Wednesday and we'd seen everything. So we were looking at to go see a movie and we'd either have to watch something again or wait till Friday. So I just always, you know, enjoyed it. There weren't really any examples in my life of people who had done it. So it was a bit of a mystery in terms of how you turn something that you're interested in, you think you want to do, into something that you go to try to actually do. So I had to sort of build a path between the idea of doing it and actually doing it. And for directing and producing especially, there isn't necessarily a path. You sort of make your own. There are examples of people who have done it and ways that they've done it, but they usually, you know, are pretty specific to whatever that person's resources are. So maybe they have a family member in the industry, or they write a book and they turn the book into a movie, or, you know, there's so many different ways that that can happen that I just kind of had to research and figure out a path that worked for me. I had a bit of a background in journalism. I wrote for a lot of local papers in Calgary back in the days when there was Fast Forward and Vox at the University of Calgary and things like that. I lived in Prince George for a little bit of time before I went to York. And I started up an arts and entertainment newspaper in Prince George. And then when I went to York University, I was the editor of one of the college papers there. So there was always, I guess, a desire to write about this stuff, which is actually not an untraditional way to go about it. If you look at like people like François Truffaut and a lot of the people from the French New Wave, started out as film critics, or, you know, cultural critics in some sense.
Yeah.
And then transitioned that into making films one way or another. And then the way I was able to do it was with documentary, because you don't necessarily need more than you and a couple people to kind of make it happen. So I made my first long documentary. It was about an hour long, about World War II bomber pilots. And it was about the very first people in the U.S. to enter the war. And I just went through the whole process. And I mean, I'd done some of those pieces before with other people's projects. But on this one, you know, I got my hands on pretty much every part of the project and learned a lot, and obviously made a lot of mistakes that I had to figure out how to fix. And then just from there, it's one of those things that I think either repels you or it kind of pulls you in deeper. Because most of these projects, especially at the beginning, you start with enough ignorance to think that you can do it.
Yeah. You don't
really understand the size of it or the scope of it.
Yeah.
So with just like force of will, chutzpah, whatever, you kind of push your way through the thing. And then afterwards, it either beats you up so bad that you don't want to go back and do it again. Or it beats you up so bad that you're like, I want to do it again, but next time I'm going to be better at it and I'm going to learn something and I want to tell a story better. And, you know, you just really want to hopefully improve your skill set.
It's a passion, you know, and you love it. It's worth it. Just, you know, keep pushing through. And I've explained to other entrepreneurs that I know, it's sort of like when you have this passion or you have this idea that you want to go with, it's like you're standing at the edge of a cliff, right? And you're not going to like grow wings by standing at the edge of the cliff. You just got to jump, and you're either going to like learn how to fly on your way down, and hopefully the bounce isn't too bad if it's not.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's a lot of people that have made one feature film or one longer project and don't ever make another one, just because psychologically it's hard to explain what it's like. The only comparison that I can think of is it's like going from running like the 100-yard dash to running a marathon. And realizing that other than, you know, moving your legs, a lot of the stuff isn't really transferable directly, because there's a different mental game, there's a different preparation, there's a different length of time that you have to kind of keep up your enthusiasm. It feels similar, but it's not really. There's a whole bunch of different skills and things that you need to be successful at the other part, the marathon running.
Well, yeah, and you're probably dealing with like so many moving parts, like even just the people alone. Right. Right. Especially, you know, when you're first starting off, right, to get people connected and to get people on board, or, you know, kind of get, you know, just them to cooperate. And
or the way I always saw it is you're kind of selling people on an idea. Right. So,
yeah,
It'd be like if you're doing a startup or something, like you have to sell them on something that isn't really there yet.
Yeah.
People have to believe that you're able to get them there. It's never been the compensation that's carried the freight.
Yeah.
It's always been sort of the belief in the project. There might be a little money. Sometimes there was no money, especially on all the short films that I did. So, you know, people really have to want to go along with you on the journey. And, you know, why do people do that? I don't know for sure. Hopefully it's because they believe that, you know, what you're doing is worthwhile. Hopefully they're getting something out of it as well. And hopefully it's like, you know, a good exchange of experiences and achieving whatever your specific goals are.
For sure. So you mentioned documentaries and short films and sci-fi. We've touched on the thriller and horror genres. What is your favorite genre to be a part of? I mean, I know you're a director, you're a producer. What is your favorite thing to do? And I guess I'm asking like two questions here to the director and producer, very different hats. But what is your favorite genre maybe to start off with?
I don't know that I have a favorite one. I basically just want to make stuff that I probably want to watch. So I either want to watch it and I, you know, feel like I have a pretty good knowledge base when it comes to film. So, you know, if there's a reason I want to watch it, presumably other people would want to watch it as well. It's got to say something about the world in some capacity or about your personal belief in the world or how you think things work. So it's got to have that kind of integrity to it, whether it's silly or, you know, serious. You know, you're not making stuff to preach at people. So it doesn't have to be heavy-handed. It can kind of be an under, you know, part of the theme. And then hopefully it's going to try to do something that hasn't quite been done before, even if that's a small deviance from stuff in the past. But hopefully you're adding, you know, the world of stories.
So maybe this next question is a bit of a, which is your favorite child? But what's your favorite project that you've worked on? Which I know is probably very tough because, you know, in the, being a creative person myself, it's, you know, you don't want to like discount anything that you've done either.
There's definitely different ones for different reasons. The one that I always wish more people had seen is Fake Blood.
That one looks great. That's like, you know what? I have not seen it, but that's on my list.
Yeah, that one, like, I'm really proud of. Like, it was, you know, a real labor of love. It's, you know, very low budget. So there was a lot of creativity to kind of make it work. That one I produced and then did a little bit of writing on, but supporting a director who had like a really strong vision and is really talented. And that was our first kind of big project together. And it just never kind of got the release that I thought it could have gotten. And there's a lot of reasons those things happen, you know. But that's definitely one of my fond memories of a film where I know I wish more people had seen it. So I like to talk about that one.
Okay, so listeners, go out and watch Fake Blood. Is it available anywhere right now? Or
I'm pretty sure it's on Amazon Prime.
Okay.
It's a weird hybrid. This is the other thing I like about it. It's kind of doing something that's a little bit unique, where it's half a documentary and half fictional, but those lines of what is what isn't clear. So the viewer doesn't necessarily know, and it's not like the first half is, you know, real and the second half isn't. It's much more convoluted than that.
Oh, okay.
And I think it's got something to say about the world that I find interesting.
Nice. So it's almost like a little bit of like found footage kind of idea.
Not found footage, though.
No? Okay.
No. No, it's just definitely like a straight up true crime style doc.
Oh, cool.
About the nature of making, you know, violent cinema, which we often do.
Yep.
And what that means and what our responsibilities may or may not be. And how that has like real world impacts and doesn't.
That's super cool. Speaking of which, so you're saying that Fake Blood, it kind of fits in this whole genre. This is around, you know, October here. So
yeah.
We're entering into the Halloween and the scary movie or horror movie season, horror and thriller. I'm going to ask you maybe, you know, kind of some of your top movies that you really like, maybe some like obscure ones that, you know, inspire you. Also, maybe some, okay, so horror movies, like what are some of like the must-sees for people?
Well, I'm so bad at remembering the films when people ask me these questions.
Yeah.
Like I'm always going to say the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Like to me, that's one of the like best horror films, and it would probably be in my top 10 list of films, period.
Groundbreaking. It was groundbreaking.
Yeah, even just the sound design in that project is like incredible. The narrative structure of it is a little bit unusual. Like it's doing a lot of things that if you read a book about how to make a movie, it's probably not breaking a lot of those rules. yet it's really, really effective and really creepy. Maybe it has one or two jump scares, but it's not built on jump scares, which I also really like, because I think that those are often kind of cheap, you know, or they're overused, I should say. And that's what some people consider a horror film. But to me, it's like the you know, the texture and the creepiness and sort of the world that's being created that kind of just digs into your subconscious. And then I think that film's probably also saying something about how people were thinking about the Vietnam War at the time. And like, I just think it's doing a lot of stuff, that movie. And, you know, obviously gave us Leatherface.
Yeah, absolutely.
Chainsaw as a weapon.
Yeah. So many places I can go from here. One of my favorites is the original Night of the Living Dead.
Oh, yeah.
The old black and white one. I thought that that too had like a lot of good messaging behind it, you know, about, you know, humanity. And that original zombie movie, you know, with John Russo, and speaks a lot to humanity and how it's never really the monster that's the problem. It's the people and how they react to the issue. And maybe being in the middle of, I hate to say, a corona, that's like, I'm looking at the same thing, right? It's like, I thought that, hey, maybe this could like bring us together, but we just like to be divided.
Well, I think it did for a minute.
Yeah.
It did. I felt like there was a month there where kind of everyone was like, okay, cool, we're on board. And then shortly thereafter, But
George Romero and John Russo on that one, that was my, one of my faves for sure. But Texas is really, really up there.
Nosferatu, you know, the black and white film?
Yeah.
Like to me, that film is like, it's, I don't know if it's scary, but it's definitely creepy. And the story about the guy who plays Nosferatu is so pretty unnerving. Like, yeah. He was never in another movie again. That was his only film, I think. And no one like knew where he was sleeping at night or wherever he was. Like there's a whole bunch of stories around that, which are pretty fun. Mm-hmm. But the movie itself, like the pacing in that movie, I always find incredible. For me anyways, how current and modern it always feels, and just, it's like just right. And never feels slow when I watch it.
Yeah, absolutely. So do a lot of filming in the Calgary area?
Yeah, we film a fair bit here in Edmonton.
I was born in Edmonton. So listeners, keep listening. But I'm also have a ton of family up there. Like, and we're all movie buffs. Like if you're hanging around us, like it's, I have a big family of, you know, three brothers and two sisters up there, and it'll be like movie reference after movie reference. It's like from the time that you like meet us to like the time you leave. But yeah, Edmonton and Calgary, very, very different feels for if you're going to film a city.
Oh yeah, big time. Edmonton has such a great arts community though.
Yeah. Well, with the U of A and everything, right? That's probably a big part of it.
Yeah, I've always had good, like, great time filming up there, that's for sure.
Yeah, and the Fringe, you know, kind of, I mean, yes, we have it here in Calgary as well, but I mean, I think it
doesn't feel the same.
It's different.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So we talked about Texas Chainsaw Massacre as a favorite horror. What has been some of your influences, perhaps, getting into film, and who's kind of stands out for you?
Well, one of them I always go to is Time Bandits, and I still love that movie. Most of the cast, if not all the cast of Monty Python, are in it. Love that movie. Midgets find a, or dwarves, or sorry, I don't know if I'm using the right language, but small people find a, find a map and that tells them how to travel through time, and they go through there to try to steal all the, you know, riches from different periods of time. And they take this little kid with them. And really, you learn that it's a battle between good and evil.
That's awesome. And I mean, yeah, the whole Monty Python cast, that's something I grew up on as well. And Holy Grail and Brian. That's, I mean, those definitely have their mark for sure.
Yeah. And for comedy, I mean, those would be sort of definitely ones I always go back to.
Remember a story of my old man first running into the Holy Grail and had no idea what it was. And it was playing on TV, and he was, you know, the whole, like, you hear the horses going, and it's very epic at the beginning of it. And it cuts to the guy using the coconuts for the horse clopping. And he just said he lost it. Yeah. So it's
the Holy Grail, apparently they did that because they didn't have the budget for horses. So they came up with that.
Oh, that's brilliant. I didn't know that. So totally creative. Yeah. If you're going to be making a film, and, you know, why hide from the fact that you don't have the budget to do this and just throw a spin on it.
It's a good lesson, actually, because, I mean, it's hard to hide the fact that you don't have money. So if you can embrace it and figure out ways to be creative with it, you know, you'll usually find a better solution. But if you try to deny the fact that, you know, you're, I don't know, making some kind of movie about rock stars or something like that, and you don't have access to rock star houses and rock star cars, and you're not going to be fooling anyone for long. Mm-hmm. It'll work against you rather than for you if you can't solve it a different way.
It's interesting to me, for my real estate business, I do videos on occasion and whatnot. And people have asked me, you know, like, first of all, to get in front of the camera is tough, right? Because you're, you know, have that whole self-conscious thing. And then putting something out there that you've made is tough. But I think when you don't have the budget, being a little more raw and authentic mm-hmm. is so much better than trying too hard or being like a tryhard, right? Like, that really comes across, like, when you film something, it's like, oh, these people are really trying, but they're really missing, right? Rather than being, if they were just authentic and worked with what they had and didn't try to fake it, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's like the soul of the thing or whatever. It's like, if you're choosing actors, let's say, and you pick the actor that just looks amazing, but they can't act.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not going to get away with it. The acting part is the soul part, and, you know, the looks part are important in film to a degree, but if you don't have the other, the one doesn't matter. So it's better to get the person that might not look right, but is a killer actor, because ultimately that's the soul of the piece, and you can't fake it.
Yeah, absolutely. I've come across a couple artists here in the last couple of years anyway, that have kind of like done their own thing, you know, video wise and whatnot, and just using their phones. Like, one was Grimes. She put out a great music video just using iPhones and stuff like that. To someone like yourself, who's, you know, definitely had your hand involved with every part of filmmaking, when you see that, what are your thoughts like when you think of, like, you know, people are just starting to use like their handhelds and whatnot? Is that kind of cringy to you, or?
Oh, no, not at all. I think it's great. I mean, ultimately, it's going to be the idea, right? That kind of sells the thing. So if it's a bad idea, it's probably not going to matter if it's, you know, using, you know, technology that's really available, or using something really expensive and fancy. If the idea is good, that's what's going to translate, I think. I think it's cool when people do that, especially when it really, you know, kind of works for the project, and they just make their limitations work for them, essentially. To me, that's what kind of creativity is about, how you work with your limitations, not having total free rein.
I love that quote. That's awesome. I'm going to steal that.
This conversation happens regularly enough, because people often look at filmmaking, and you can look at it this way, as a series of compromises, right? You know, you don't have access to this person, or these lenses aren't available, or your budget doesn't give you the extra thing that you want. And it's sort of constant throughout the process of making a movie. So, you know, you can look at it as compromises, or you can, and sometimes they are, right? I mean, you can't get away from that completely. But most of the time, it's more about trying to figure out a creative solution, figuring out what the intent of something is, figuring out what the themes are, figuring out kind of like what the base level stuff you're trying to actually do is, and then trying to get creative with the solutions and not losing sight of the meaning of the thing.
That totally makes sense. So for budding filmmakers, or somebody that's like looking to get into this, or maybe start their own little project or whatever, what would you say, you know, because I'm playing off the name of the podcast and playing off my name, what would you say would be an epic fail that somebody like, just like, stay away from this, like, don't even like, or even it could be mindset, or it could be whatever.
Basically, there's a lot of people that want to do this. So, you know, if you want to do this, you probably think you have something to say, but make sure you do have something to say, or why are you doing it? Life experience is a good thing, and people sometimes start before they have maybe enough of it. So they haven't quite developed their voice yet. I guess the biggest thing would, you know, patience, because it doesn't happen quickly, and you're probably going to be most likely broke for a long time.
Hey, it's the starving artist, right?
Well, I mean, you get into the things where people are like, well, I'll do this, you know, I'll do this while I try to work on that. And sometimes that works. So they go and, you know, say, for example, they want to make feature films, but they make corporate videos. It's rare that you see someone transition from sort of making corporate videos, making money, and then going into feature films successfully.
Well, probably because you're making decent money at your with your corporate. So to throw any of that away is probably pretty tough.
I think there's also habits and just ways of thinking that you don't get to kind of exercise and work on while you're making some of those types of things. Of course, there's exceptions to everything though, right? So,
yeah, absolutely.
And then the other thing I'd say is just understand storytelling and the grammar of visual language. That's another thing that I think people sometimes aren't as sharp on.
Like, yeah, if it comes to like scripting and whatnot, and maybe, you know, this is ignorance, but, you know, from knowing limited directors, but I mean, Tarantino, like I love his writing and his dialogue is insane. It's brilliant. So
more like if you're making a brochure for a house, right? So we'll create an analogy between that and a film.
Yeah.
So on your brochure, you're going to include certain things, right? There's a little bit of creativity that you can apply to that, but there's certain things that if you, you know, say you showed only close-ups of the, like the plugs or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
That would be a really strange choice, but you're like, yeah, but the power in this house is incredible. And I want people to know that.
Yeah.
That probably wouldn't be the best way to, you know, sort of tell that story about the house. Even if that was something you wanted to highlight, you know, say you were first starting selling houses, you might make the mistake of being like, well, that's what it should be on the poster because that's the most important part is how many outlets they have.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever the thing is.
Yeah.
And people often, you know, they is a process, right, to start being able to make good films, which I think I'm getting close to. And it takes a long time. And there's a lot of work in the craft part, even before you sort of talk about the art part.
Absolutely. And that just comes with time and experience where you're having that vision. And I think sometimes stepping outside yourself is important. You know, like if we're talking like on the creative side, it's kind of looking at it from another angle, right? And not just being myopic with your vision.
You can get tons of great ideas from other places. Ultimately, you're responsible for them one way or the other. So if you fight for a decision because it's bad, but it's yours, you know, why would you do this? But people do it all the time. Even though someone has a better idea, sometimes people think they lose, you know, authority or credibility. I'm not sure. But you're still going to, at the end of the day, take responsibility for that decision. And you've made the choice to either use someone else's idea if they have a better one or use your own, you know? But if yours isn't the better idea, why would you fight for it? It does happen all the time. I see that regularly.
I think that happens like everywhere where you hear about, you know, somebody, even in the corporate world where they'll have like, they proposing an idea and somebody else is proposing an idea. And even though the boss, the big boss may have the weaker idea, they want to stick with it because they're the big boss, right? And it's like, they don't want to show any kind of weakness or inferiority or anything, which it isn't. This is a creative process and it's, you know, just go with a better idea.
Ultimately it's the opposite, but in the moment, sometimes it looks that way. And I'm sure we're all guilty of this to some degree. But there's definitely degrees to this that I've seen in the past, yeah.
For sure. So when you're not making films, what do you like to do around Calgary? What's your jam?
Man, lately, not too much. Lately, I mean, geez, we're all pretty homebound. It's basically...
I guess lately, right? Yeah.
Taking the dogs for a walk, trying to watch movies, spending time with the family, reading. Like, I love reading fantasy novels.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What's your favorite author?
Probably Joe Abercrombie.
Okay.
He's probably my favorite author. And it was Game of Thrones that got me back into reading them. I hadn't read them since junior high, I don't think. And I used to read them like crazy. I think it was the Dragonlance series or something like that. Go through a book a week kind of thing. And then I just stopped for some reason. And then since Game of Thrones, whenever that was, 7 years ago or something, I was like, oh, this looks pretty cool. After the first season, I was like, I'll check it out. I read it and I like went through the whole series and or up to, you know, minus the last book in like something like a month and a half or something like that. Like I barely slept. I was just like up all night reading. I was like, one more chapter. Nice. Anyways, so I've been reading a lot of those ever since.
So is that something you would want to get into film wise?
Yeah, I want to make a really violent barbarian film at some point.
Yeah, that'd be super cool.
Basically, it's the same like story tropes as a Western, right? So yeah, it'd be really fun to do that. But I haven't figured out the story for that yet, but I will.
The original Conan, and people laugh at me when I say this, but the original Conan the Barbarian is a brilliant movie. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah,
it's epic.
The music is awesome. Yeah, it's just everything about it is great.
And it's pretty like hands-on. There's not much fantasy in it. Pretty much like, you know, a guy and a gun, but in this case, a guy and a sword. Yeah, it's awesome. I just read there's a Paul Verhoeven script who did Total Recall with Schwarzenegger.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And it was a film that was supposed to get produced and then didn't. It was, I think, going to be like the first $100 million budgeted film. And there was two films that I think Carolco or someone was trying to push. And it was the pirate movie that won. And it was like a Rennie Harlan movie with Gina Davis and Matthew Modine or something like that.
Oh, yeah. I think I remember that. Yeah.
So apparently it was like these two films, they were trying to decide which one to make. And Paul Verhoeven had a script about the Crusades starring Schwarzenegger and I guess a bunch of the other cast were in place. So a friend of mine, I didn't know this story, it's new to me, which is a nice surprise because I thought I knew a fair bit about Paul Verhoeven and sort of that era of film. It's about the Crusades, but it really feels like a better sequel to the first Conan than the actual sequel.
Oh, God, that one's all, yeah, I don't know.
Awesome. It's a really cool script. I wish they would have made it. It's like, I mean, it's definitely all of his stuff very political. Like, I mean, all the Crusaders, or not all the Crusaders, most of the Crusaders are like, you know, child killers and rapists.
Oh.
And it's dark and violent, but man, I wish they made that movie.
Yeah, that would have been super cool. It's interesting. And you mentioned that, and you say how just the ultra violence and whatnot, and you mentioned your movie Fake Blood and how it talks about people's perception of the industry and violence in movies and whatnot. But if we look at historically, you know, some of these things that are pretty watered down that have happened in history, and there are some really ultra violent times. And I think, yeah, in order to really portray some of these things, you have to have that element in your film.
Fake Blood gets into that a little bit, but like The Dark Knight, I mean, they kill a ton of people in that movie.
Oh, yeah.
But there's no blood, right? So these people get shot all throughout the film, but there's just no sort of impact wound or blood part of the death. So, I mean, is that worse or better? I don't know.
Is that maybe desensitizing people, right? Like if, right?
That's what I mean. Yeah. Like, so is it better to show kind of, I mean, I guess it's up to the filmmaker, of course, but you know, there's probably a reasonable argument to like that is more desensitizing and sort of, if this stuff is harmful, which I'm not sure it is, that might be more so.
To water it down or to downplay it, I think is, in my opinion, worse, right? I think if you're going to show something gruesome, you know, show it in its kind of true nature.
Yeah, or like Tarantino exaggerates it, you know? They typically do that for ratings, right? So they can make the film PG. I rewatched the Michael Keaton Batman film recently. That's actually a great thing that's been happening is the drive-ins on COVID. I love it. I got to see Blade Runner and I got to see, you know, the Michael Keaton Batman movie. But I remember when everyone was talking about, was it the Superman movie or one of the movies that they came out with recently and how, maybe it was Batman? Batman killing people or Superman's killing people and no one would ever do that, right? Part of both of their mythology that they are basically people that don't kill people, right? They won't stoop to that level to, you know, to fight their battles. There's like so many people that die in that 1990 Batman.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Yeah, they just don't show it, right? So they'll show the point up to the place where someone would die and then the cut. So like you've got like the when he blows up the factory at the end of the movie and is driving out.
Yeah.
There's, I don't know, dozens, maybe hundreds of people, henchmen in that building.
Yeah.
That building like blows to smithereens. Like those people did not escape. I was surprised by that because I didn't remember that at all.
Yeah, I'd have to rewatch that now. I think there is a space for a cutaway shot. And I heard, I think it was actually John Russo that was talking about this, which is funny that he would say this because he's like Fangoria magazine and all this other stuff, right? And he's very, very kind of gory. But he said the brilliance of a cutaway, like a well-done cutaway shot, is that the human mind and the human, our imagination is so much worse than what you could ever show, right? So if it's if it's done right, a cutaway shot can be amazing.
Way more violent.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. If it's timed right. Yeah. I think we do a good job of that with Knuckleball and Harpoon and Alive. That's something that we talk about a lot internally. It'll make something way more impactful if you cut usually the second before you would kind of see the thing that was going to happen, either the impact or the, like there's, yeah. And then the sound that goes with it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I had to own the sound. Yeah.
We're just in a sound mix for that werewolf movie. And we were, you know, working on the werewolf transformation. And like, there's a moment when the actor kind of feels like her back kind of folds as she falls to her knees and hands as she's transforming.
Yeah.
And we added some like kind of back cracking sounds in there. And like, it just like the visceral response to this is crazy. Like, it just feels like your whole back is like, might be breaking or something.
Your hair's on the back and your back kind of pop awesome. Up. And
it's like awesome when you can do that.
Yeah. That's the thing about movies. And do you like going out to the theater much? Do you like a home theater?
No, I love going to the movies.
Yeah. I grew up doing the same thing. Like, I mean, it wasn't maybe twice a week, but it was quite often, you know, where it was both my parents, we loved going to the movies. And even still to this day, like it's the whole experience. And I look at like, you know, what COVID has done and people saying like, oh, the movie theater is dead because you're not going to have people wanting to get in groups, or everybody can just do it from home now and they don't have to go to the theater. But for me, I'm like, it's the whole experience. Like, even, you know, when buying the ticket and thinking, okay, do I want to see this one or that one? And then the with the smell, like the popcorn that's going, and you know, even the sticky floors, right? It's like, there's a whole experience there that's like part of the movie going experience that I've just always been in love with.
Yeah, I still love it. And I still like going to movies by myself. When they kind of started to open up the theaters during COVID and they've got like, you know, the really limited seating, they were playing really cool stuff. Like they were playing Friday the 13th. So I got to see that in the theater for the first time during COVID. That was awesome.
I saw there was a company, they had an Eventbrite thing and you could put your name in to reserve seating, but they were doing like a movie on the lake.
Oh, yeah.
And so they're doing like a big floating movie screen. And it was, I don't know if it was in like Mahogany Lake or Auburn Bay or whatever.
Yeah.
But I thought, I was like, if they don't do Jaws, like that's like, there's only one movie. If you get, and it's what you would do is they had it where like the movie screen was like in the lake, sort of like, you know, like one of those outdoor movie festivals, but then they would have boats. Like, you know,
that sounds great.
Eight person boats and you'd all go out into this like,
yeah.
And I thought that would be so amazing. But I think the COVID thing kind of put an end to that. But I thought that would be so cool.
Well, hopefully that's one thing that comes back, is that the drive-in sticks around.
Right. Like that was so cool. I mean, I only got to experience it a few times, mm-hmm. you know, drive-in, but I thought it was an awesome thing.
I got to take my kids to Blade Runner.
Original?
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
It was super fun.
Yeah.
And we went to something at the Calgary Underground Film Festival as well. And that was their first drive in there. I was like, you got to come to this. And they're like, what is it? I don't understand. How do you listen to the, how do you hear the movie? What? I was like, it comes through the radio. And they're like, what? Anyway, they were just like, their minds were blown a little bit. It was really exciting.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's super exciting. And it's something different and out of the norm. And I'm really liking that. There's a lot of this kind of stuff, you know, whether it's movies or other things are popping up, like locked rooms and axe throwing and combative archery kind of the things that are going on. I think it's great that we have some of this stuff in Calgary.
Yeah, for sure.
You had mentioned your other movies. Are they available in like physical format, or is it only digital download?
Fuck, I don't know, man. Like it's it's hard to keep track of where they all are exactly, but I mean, usually if you just search them, you can, you know, find them.
Yeah.
So most of them would be available. And, you know, there's actually a really cool collector's edition of Harpoon through a company in Canada called Black Fawn, which is like a limited edition box set, which has a bunch of extras on it. And it comes with like a little survival kit and it's pretty fun. That's some limited number. I don't know how many, 500 or 1,000, whatever the number is. That's a cool one. Knuckleball, you can get on. I'm sure you can order it on Amazon, I think, if you want a physical. most of them will have something similar to that. Otherwise, Knuckleball should be on Crave. Fake Blood, I think, is on Amazon. Harpoon is on Super Channel. Can't recall where Alive is. Alive was just at the movie theaters here, though.
Yeah, do you want? I saw that.
Did you?
Yep.
I was Angus McFadden's stunt double in that.
It's good. It's good.
Fake Ball off the cliff, get the bus smashed in the face.
Yeah.
The lady on top of you with the needle.
Yeah, that was awesome. The werewolf movie.
Oh, yeah.
Release date is when on that one?
I'm not sure, because it'll go through a festival run. Like, we know who our distributor is in Canada, but usually you wait to find out who it is in the States first. And then based on the States release schedule, you sort of piggyback on it in Canada.
Naturally,
yeah. Have a bigger impact, you know, out there. But yeah, that's a second feature by a director out of Montreal who actually shot my interview when I was at the Fantasia Festival. When Michael Ironside and I were there, she was the camera operator.
Okay.
For our interview. And then, you know, 3 years later, we're working together and I'm helping produce her feature with another local producer who was also the co-writer of it, Wendy Hill too. So yeah, that was kind of had some cool synergy to it. You know, you meet this person in the past, you run into them again, and then you're looking for a director and, you know, what are the chances?
Nice. Yeah. Do you have a title on the werewolf movie?
Oh yeah. Sorry. It's called Bloodthirsty.
Bloodthirsty.
Yeah. And it has a really cool soundtrack.
And this is such a controversy with me, but do you try to stick with Canadian artists or do you try to branch out?
The practical answer is a little more complicated. Sometimes it makes more sense or it doesn't make economic sense to work with people down south or not from Canada. Sometimes it makes more sense because there's usually larger name actors and things like that from down south. It's kind of all over the place. Like, I really am trying to just work with people that I think are going to be a pleasure to work with and make cool projects. Like, if I boil it down to something.
And that's sort of where I stand with the arts, because I know from, you know, previous things I've done is that there's, you know, the whole Canadian content, that's a thing. I'm more of the idea there should be freedom, creative freedom. So if I find a guy in Japan that's like really cool that I want to work with, or a guy in the States or whatever, just be happy that I'm a Canadian producing something that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, ultimately the market isn't really here. It's a world market, right? So if you made stuff that was only suiting the Canadian market, I don't know how long you'd be around necessarily.
Yeah, it'd be, right? Yeah.
Especially for the kind of stuff that I'm making, like, it's just, you don't have the market here to support it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of everywhere else that supports it ultimately, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Alrighty. Well, I think that's about it. That about wraps it up.
Yeah.
So, Mike, thank you very much for being on the Epic Phelan podcast. If somebody wants to check you out, where are they going to go?
On Twitter, Film Peterson. And then on Facebook, I think it's Mike Peterson or Michael Peterson.
Right on. Awesome. All right. So again, Mike, it was great to meet you and great to have the interview. And until next time, stay epic. Thanks again for listening to Epic Phelan. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe, give me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, follow me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Real Ryan Phelan, and visit my website at thecalgaryrealestateguy.com. Until next time, stay epic.